Hi, folks. It's me. Today's episode is brought to you by SunsetLakeSabadet.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. As you know, it's all one word, incidentally, that left is best. I think you can see that. SunsetLakeSabadet.com grows, harvests, and ships all of its craft Sabadet products directly from its farm in northern Vermont, right near Burlington, straight to your door. Skip the lines and get your relief or your fun or your relaxation from SunsetLakeSabadet.com. SunsetLakeSabadet.com is a vertically integrated farm that aims to provide affordable Sabadet products to everybody. These guys are movement partners. Their politics are great, and it's reflected in the way they do business, in the way they sell their stuff. They cut out the middlemen. They ship your product, their products directly from their farm to your door. They are your trusted one-stop shop for all your hemp and Sabadet needs. They grow their own Sabadet. They provide third-party testing. You get a full breakdown of everything that's in the product. And with every order, incidentally, they also take pride in its best-in-business customer service. If you have an issue, they want to know so you can make it right. They do not use AI or bots to steer you in circles. When you get in touch with Sunset Lake, you're going to be talking to a real-life person. They're also going to be very friendly. Those guys up there, all of them, are super cool. They got products for everybody. They got stuff that helps you sleep, tinctures, gummies. They got focus gummies that focus you so much that Brian can't even take them. Too intense. He was too focused. Listen, if you're already starting at a 10 on focus, you don't want to take the focus gummies. But maybe you could take the relax gummies. They also have some with THC and Delta Na. I can't say those words, not in this context. They've got topicals to help you with your sore muscles, help you with your eczema if you want to use it off label like I do. They got smokable hemp. They got kief and pre-rolls. They have it all. They even have some tincture for your pets. If you order, if your order is over $75, Sunset Lake Sabadet can ship your order for free. And when you create an account at Sunset Lake Sabadet's website, you can start earning rewards points and earn 10% back on all your purchases. You can refer your friends to Sunset Lake Sabadet and send them a coupon for their first order, and you earn $10 store credit with every successful referral. Just honestly, an all-around great company. They're movement partners. They've donated tens of thousands of dollars through the years. Check them out. SunsetLakeSabadet.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST and get 20% off. Now time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 27th, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ryan Grimm. What is it? What is, oh yeah, Drop Site and Counterpoints host and frequent guest on the show. He was live in the Mamdani election party. Also on the program today, Dr. Adam Gaffney, pulmonary ICU doctor, healthcare researcher at the Cambridge Health Justice Lab. They just released a study that shows the devastating impact on human life that this bill the Republicans are trying to pass will reek. Meanwhile, speaking of reeking, Supreme Court dropped a couple of rulings today. In fact, the last of their term. The two biggest, they have limited nationwide injunctions and to undermine birthright citizenship. Another ruling also allows religion to supersede all other rights in many respects by allowing parents to withdraw children from classes that in any way include books, that in any way mention anybody who's lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer. Back in the Senate, the parliamentarian continues to strip from the Republican fat cat bill. The worst of it still remains. John Thune may have to keep Republican senators working over the weekend as they struggle to tear healthcare away from millions and give millions back to rich people. New York State Senator Kirsten Gillibrand goes full Islamophobe in wake of the Mamdani win. Trump's DOJ pressuring the UVA president to resign because of, yes, DEI. Bob Kennedy's anti-vax board votes to remove thimerosal from the flu vaccine, even though it's not in most of the flu vaccines in this country, but it will probably make that vaccine out of reach for some poor people. IDF soldiers tell Haaretz that they were ordered to shoot unarmed Palestinians waiting for Gaza food aid. U.S. economy shrunk more in Q1 than previously announced as tariff evasion drove our GDP down. And finally, rest in peace, Bill Moyers, one of the truly great journalists of several eras, dies at age 91. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. Emma is still on her honeymoon.
Crazy.
How long is this thing going to last?
4 months.
It's been 4 days, right? What?
I mean, in terms of news, which is how I measure things, it's been about 4 months.
Actually, no. I mean, she couldn't have. It is hard to imagine a week where there would have been more news. She, of course, is going to be gone for another week because, you know, it's her honeymoon. But even still.
Whatever.
We have seen a wide array of of responses to Zohran Mamdani really spanking Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic primary for mayor. Now, just an update. Cuomo has decided that there is not going to be, he is not going to give up his ballot access. The deadline passed, I think, yesterday. That does not mean that he's going to run, but it does sound like he's going to see how much money he can get to run. They are scrambling big time. I'm sure you guys yesterday spoke about the Bill Ackman.
Yep, segment one.
Insane rant on. I've been getting up in the middle of the night, like at three, and I know I shouldn't go on Twitter, but like I still, because of the whole Zohran thing, like I do. And I saw him, he had tweeted at one in the morning, and it was literally something that he must have been writing all day. And it ended with, we're going to do a writing candidate. And I will tell you, the level of insanity associated with something like that is enormous. And just on top of the fact, like, dude, you're literally saying that you're going to try and buy this election. This is all stuff that you should never have written down for publishing. I mean, you should never do any of what you're talking about, and you shouldn't be you. But I understand that you are. But you should not be tweeting that out like that. It is in the your absolute worst interest, which allows me to believe that, honestly, he's just crazy. I know you've gone over yesterday a wide array of the right-wing bigotry that was unleashed, and it's almost as if they it is what I call everything bagel bigotrism. And they don't know which element of the bagel, of the everything on the bagel, that they want to focus in on. And I understand folks like Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, you know, giving sort of half-hearted, not so congratulations or, you know, recognition, because, of course, their donors are very concerned about Mom Donnie, probably more from a taxation standpoint. And also, broadly speaking, they all know that things like this create broader implications in our body politic. It's not just New York City they're worried about. It's not just the added 2% if I make over $1 million. You know, the $20,000 for a millionaire is just, you know, people like $20,000 if you have $1 million, but it's not that big of a deal. They are concerned about it spreading and it giving people hope. And it's the precedent they're concerned about. But I have to say that with all of that, as jaded as I am, I was shocked to hear the audio of Kristen Gillibrand on WNYC. And I'll tell you something, like, I heard about this seconds after it was on air from total normies who texted me and were like, you cannot believe, all Jews, incidentally, too. I heard it from three people within like 10 minutes who listened to Brian Lehr, which I now okay. Back in the day at Air America, at one point I was on against him, in which case it was not appropriate to listen to him. But they all texted me some variation of, you cannot believe what Kristen Gillibrand just did on Brian Lehr's show. It was bizarre, insane, bigoted, nuts, I think were some variation of those. Here is, now understand, Brian Lehr's show, it's a local show, but it's New York City, so it's quite large. It's bigger than most, probably national shows even, maybe, or some. He takes phone calls. When he has guests on, he takes phone calls, and they ask the guest question. And you will always get a wide array of guests. So the issue here is not so much, I'm not so surprised about the caller, and I'm not so surprised about the caller, you know, sort of like presenting a series of lies or exaggerations or manipulations that Lehr can't address. And to be clear, Lehr was not a Mamdani guy in the run-up to the election. But I don't know. I think he was almost worried about getting sued at this point. But listen to not just the caller. That's almost less relevant. It is less relevant. Listen to Kristen Gillibrand. This is her speaking, incidentally, hot off the heels of her midwifing the Genius Act. I mean, she was, I don't know if she was the author, but she was certainly one of the co-sponsors. The Genius Act is a crypto bill that is going to be, I guarantee you, I don't know that I'll still be around. Maybe I'll be down to one a week at that point. But in 5, 10, 15 years, we're going to have a financial meltdown, and it's going to be because of this, among other things, probably, but that genius bill. But this is just completely insane.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call and question. I wanted to ask two very pertinent questions about the threats facing the Jewish community, unfortunately, from Zohar Mamdani. There was a bill that I was reading about that, unfortunately, he wants to target synagogues and Jewish institutions which donate to nonprofits, which are medical institutions like United Hatzalah and Magan Devod David Adam, which is like the Jewish Red Cross. So how do we make sure that Jewish institutions are protected from his plans to punish and fine our institutions which fundraise these medical nonprofits, which do work both here in the United States and in Israel and other countries in the world? And also, how can we hold Mr. Mamdani accountable for his glorifying association of Hamas and other terror bombings of the Intifada in 1990s, where over 1,000 Jewish Israelis were killed, to his revisionist Holocaust knowledge, to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, where Jews were mass exterminated and faced threats? He compared when Jews were killed to when Jews fought back against Nazis. It's quite despicable. I'm sorry.
Gabe, thank you for your call. There's a lot in there, Senator, some of which may be inaccurate. So I don't know. I can't fact check everything in real time. But do you know any of that to be inaccurate or accurate, including the original premise that he would somehow target synagogues if they were contributing to groups like Hatzalah, ambulance services, in a way that he could hurt the synagogues? I just don't want to give out information that's false, but I also don't want to shrink from information that's true.
Well, the caller is exactly the New York constituents that I've spoken to that are alarmed. They are alarmed by past public statements. They are alarmed by past positions, particularly references to global jihad. This is a very serious issue because people that glorify the slaughter of Jews create fear in our...
That's her first lie. He didn't say we should engage in global jihad. Like, you're a U.S. senator. And incidentally, this is obviously sped up a little bit. So, like, this wasn't, you know, she misspoke, I guess. She's being very fast and loose. Global jihad. Okay.
Past positions, particularly references to global jihad. This is a very serious issue because people that glorify the slaughter of Jews create fear in our communities. The global
Pause
intifada
it for a second.
Is
people that glorify the slaughter of Jews create fear in our communities. Who's glorifying the slaughter of Jews? She's talking about Zohran Mamdani. Is she claiming he's glorifying the slaughter of Jews? Maybe Christian Gillibrand should call Brad Lander. Maybe Christian, is her name Christian Gillibrand or is it Kristen? I think it's Kristen. Maybe she should check in with a Jew before she starts claiming that Mamdani is glorifying the slaughter of Jews. Unbelievable.
This is a very serious issue because people that glorify the slaughter of Jews create fear in our communities. The global intifada is a statement that means destroy Israel and kill all the Jews. So
pause it for a second. That is also a lie. It doesn't mean either one of those things. Like, in no possible way does it mean kill all the Jews. It doesn't really mean destroy Israel either, but like that's like three steps away. If you wanted to sort of like really, you know, fudge it a little bit, you could get to destroy Israel or destroy the ethno state as opposed to, you know, like a political revolution. But in no one's even fever dreams does it mean kill all the Jews or any Jews?
These are the kinds of things that if Mr. Mamdani is elected our mayor, we'll need to assure all New Yorkers that he will protect all Jews and protect houses of worship and protect funding for not-for-profits that meet the needs
Pause
of these communities.
It.
Those are the things.
Pause it. Maybe she doesn't get over-the-air television, and maybe she hasn't heard of Colbert, but like, in addition to him doing this on the campaign over and over again, he was on with Brad Lander being extremely explicit about this. And Brad Lander saying, like, in fact, not only we're going to have, you know, to have a Jew and a Muslim going around campaigning together is as New York as it gets. And incidentally, those not-for-profits that meet the needs of these communities, the needs, the community that she's referring to, maybe she doesn't know, are illegal settlements in the West Bank that were illegal under Joe Biden. Now, Israel has said that they're legal now. They're still illegal under what has been everybody's past policy, including Biden's, maybe short of Donald Trump's, and certainly international law.
He'll have to do as our mayor.
He would certainly say that he has committed to protecting all Jews in New York as mayor of New York. Do you dispute? Pause it for a second.
Now, Lear says this in a sideways way. He should have probably, he said, well, he has committed. It's not that he would say that. He has committed. Now, you may not believe him. He could be a secret sleeper cell. But he not only would say that he said that, he has said that. Go ahead.
Do you doubt that?
Well, I one of the issues I did talk to him yesterday was exactly this issue, and he has agreed to work with me on this and to protect all residents.
Okay, pause it. This is where Kristen Gillibrand seems to have a repeat offender despicable problem. If you read the Jane Mayer story about Al Franken, she came out and called for his resignation when it was already clear that he was going to do that. And her coming out and saying, like, she's going to take credit for him to protect all. No, he's been saying that from day one. Go ahead.
This is something I care deeply about, and so I will be an advocate on these issues. These are things that I think are important to New Yorkers.
Oh, pause it. You know what else she was an advocate on? It seems to me sexual harassment in the military, and I'm trying to think who it was that Zohran Mamdani was running against. Oh, yes, a serial sexual harasser. Go ahead.
Advocate on these issues. These are things that I think are important to New Yorkers. And I will work with him when he gets elected, if he gets elected, to make sure everyone is protected. I also, on the federal level, work to get resources for all our religious sites in the state and in the city. I lead the letter for funding for... for the funding to protect synagogues and churches and temples and places of worship across our city and state.
Oh, wait a second. I'm trying to think of what are the three big religions in the state. Christianity, they go to churches, and Jews go to temples, although sometimes you call it synagogues. Hindus go to temple.
That about covers it.
I feel like... mosques.
I'll have to look that up in the dictionary.
It's funny. It's funny how global jihad comes right to mind. But mosque, I forgot the name of it.
For the funding to protect synagogues and churches and temples and places of worship across our city and state. And these are things that he has assured me in my one conversation that he will protect everyone. But I understand why people are concerned because of past statements. And so this is just an issue that I will work with him on for sure.
I just feel compelled to say, we can find no evidence that he has supported Hamas or has supported violent jihad, as that caller was asserting. Can you?
Again, Brian, I don't have all the data and information, and I've never sat down with Mr. Mamdani. So I've asked to have that meeting. I'm going to have that meeting. We will talk through all these things. He can tell me his views of the world.
Oh, pause it. I hope we can we get a live stream of you asking him if he's in favor of Hamas and violent jihad? This is just unbelievable. If she doesn't get primaried, I will be shocked. If she doesn't get primaried, I may just spare my run against Schumer and run against her. Oh, did I say that?
Get the Kirsten out.
Someone's going to get re-Gillibranded. I don't know. We got to work on the slogan.
We will win. We will win.
It's unbelievable that it's unbelievable. She needs to issue an apology, multiple apologies.
Well, her comms person said she misspoke, so not enough to apologize for it, but she misspoke.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was this she misspoke? Was this a special episode of the Brian Lehrer Show, not on in the late morning, but rather at like 3 a.m. on a Friday night? Folks, a while back, let's hear a word from our sponsor, shall we? A while back, I noticed I was a little thinning on top of my head. And I didn't want to take anything that was drug-based. And we actually had Nutrafol in the office. But subsequent to that, or I should say prior to that, no, we had Nutrafol in the office because years ago they had tried to pitch us the sponsor and it didn't happen because nobody here felt like they needed to take it. I started taking it. And after that, or prior to that, I think it was, both Emma and someone else I know had told me stories of women they knew that had a great experience with Nutrafol. And so I figured, why not? It is a it's a hair growth supplement. I'm sure you've wondered, do they work? Fair question. Many hair supplements overpromise and underdeliver, but Nutrafol is different. It's the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement. It's trusted by over 1.5 million people. It's clinically tested to deliver real results in just 3 to 6 months. And like I say, I know of two women firsthand who have had a great experience. And I have also had a great experience. Thinning hair is different for men and women. It's a so one size fits all for the hair growth doesn't cut it. No pun intended. Nutrafol has multiple formulas for men and women that are tailored to fit different lifestyles and stages, I should say. Postpartum or menopause, lifestyle factors like a plant-based lifestyle, so you can get what you need. Plus, users of Nutrafol men reported no impact to sexual performance. And I will also not report any impact to sexual performance. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol actually tests the full recipe, essentially. And they have a very sophisticated metrics like hair counts and pull tests to track improvements in growth, quality, shedding, and texture. Building a hair growth routine is easy. Order online. You don't need a prescription. Enjoy free shipping, automated deliveries, 20% savings with a subscription. Plus, you get free naturopathic doctor consults and a Headspace meditation membership because your brain is under your hair. Start your hair growth journey with Nutrafol for a limited time. Nutrafol offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com. Enter the promo code TMR. Find out why Nutrafol is the best-selling hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. Spend Nutrafol.com. Promo code TMR10. That's Nutrafol.com. Promo code TMR and the number 10. We'll put a link in the podcast and YouTube description. Quick break and Ryan Grimm. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ryan Grimm, the founder and co-founder of the site DropSite, which you can find on Substack. We'll put a link to that. And also the co-host of Counterpoints on the Breaking Point.
Wait, for this exact reason, we are actually like phasing out the name Counterpoints because it's just so confusing. Counterpoints on the Breaking Points channel. So it's just all going to be Breaking Points now.
Oh.
So we'll just have four co-hosts of Breaking Points, but like two a day.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
we will win.
We just broke some news, did we?
You did. There you go.
Okay, there we go. Emma Vigeland on her honeymoon. It's already been 4 days. I don't know what she's doing. But there's a couple stories I want to talk about. But let's obviously start with the big, big, big one. You literally wrote the book about winning a campaign when they have money, but we have people. Mm-hmm. The name of your book, I'm not sure if you recall, the first one was They Have Money, We Have People.
Yeah, there you go. And, underpinning that is that you also do need a little bit of money, not just people. And New York City's matching funds, I don't know if it necessarily made this possible because, as you know, Mamdani was turning money away. But without the match getting him into the kind of credibility, viability range, maybe he doesn't get that amount of small dollars. Because people don't want to just give to anybody who is going to get 3%.
Absolutely. And you can't manage 50,000 volunteers unless you have some paid staff.
Exactly. And you can't like organize that number of volunteers without some paid staff and they might show up once and then it's a disastrous experience. You know, nobody's got a clipboard for you. They don't tell you what to do. It's hot out. And you're like, well, I tried.
Yeah.
But so to make it a fulfilling and enriching and useful experience for these volunteers, you have to have it well structured and organized to get them to not just come back, but then to recruit their friends. So yeah, you do need money too. Which he had.
All right. So track this for us. I know that you interviewed Mamdani like 7 months, like it's maybe around January, I think.
November the first time.
November.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Give me your sense of like how this tracked over the campaign. I mean, we interviewed him in January and I noticed like about a month or two ago that the title was still like, is he going to beat Adams? And, we're like, oh, we should change that. Now, of course, it's back in play because Adams had dropped out. But, what happened here? I mean, what do you attribute this to?
That's interesting. You know, he had to get past a threshold of support, which means he had to start raising enough money that he'd start getting his name out there. And he did that very early. And thanks to these matching funds, you know, up to $250, it's matched like six times or something. So he had, you know, by early January, a significant amount of money to start spending on, you know, social media ads and to put together a team that could then produce these really well done, you know, social videos that were getting out there. And he hit the podcast circuit, you know, pretty hard. So there, you know, you can reach kind of a threshold amount of people who are like very plugged, because they're very plugged into politics. Like,
right.
In fact, outside of the campaign headquarters on Tuesday night, I met a woman who was going to an exercise class. She was wearing a Zoran shirt, and she said, "Hey, I love Breaking Points, and I love the Majority Report." Like, I was.
She said both.
Yes, she watched the Majority Report.
In that order? Okay.
Well, Breaking Points is in the morning. Majority Report is in the afternoon.
Okay, that
makes sense.
Okay, that tracks. Yeah. That tracks.
Yes. And she said, like, you know, she was constantly wanted to watch these programs to get updates on Zoran. And like, but she'd been watching it for a long time. So that's the kind of person that's going to then volunteer for the campaign. So you can So because of this independent media pipeline, you can actually reach them. And then at some point, I think the public woke up to the fact that Andrew Cuomo was seriously trying to have another act as mayor of New York City. So then needed to start paying attention to this election and to see who the viable opponents were. And by the time people were paying attention, Mamdani was viable and had a message that resonated with people, which is that the city's unaffordable. Like you have to make several million dollars a year. You tell me in New York City for that not to resonate with you.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, yeah. I mean the city is incredibly expensive. And it does resonate across a very wide spectrum of what, you know, people would be surprised, I think, if you live in other, you know, in smaller cities, just like how wide that resonates. I mean, I had people the day after the election approach me about childcare, and they're like, you know, we're spending, you know, $40,000 a year on childcare. Right. And now look, there's obviously cheaper childcare, but I don't know that you could get it cheaper than like 15,000. I mean, I was in a co-op 12 years ago for nursery school, you know, and that was 12 years ago. It was around that amount of money, but you could say, you know, save money by a co-op, but this and that, but it helps just the idea of being seen in that way by a candidate, I think. But what's fascinating to me is that it feels like the Cuomo campaign and the entire Democratic establishment was so upset the day after, whether that was like in the CNBC crew. I mean, obviously, let's put the right to aside for a moment. It is amazing to me because we have seen, starting with the Howard Dean campaign, which was in 2004, that there's a shift in the dynamic of how campaigns are run. And the reason why the primary is in June in New York State is because it was a incumbent or a big name protection racket.
Right.
They have the machine. Cuomo knew from day one he was going to get his whatever 350,000 votes that are going to come from the machine that has been built.
Right.
And they just assume nobody can get a higher number than that. So if we put it in the summer, you know, people won't come out. They don't realize that this alternative mechanism to at least get a jump start. I mean, look, Mamdani is a great candidate, you know, and not everybody could do that. They don't realize there's a mechanism, there's a counter machine that exists now that didn't exist, let's say, 30 years ago.
Yeah, AOC found that exact kind of crack because it was right around the exact same time that her primary was scheduled against Joe Crowley. 40,000 people voted in that primary. This is a district that represents roughly 700,000 people. So, you know, Zoran had, 50,000 volunteers? She needed like 16,000 votes total to knock off one of the most powerful Democrats in the entire country. It's sort of, it's like a Death Star situation where somebody like put a little like flaw in the blueprint that this will work unless you can excite people and get them out to the polls. And Democrats could not imagine a world in which voters could get excited to go to the polls and vote for somebody other than the party machine hack that was being put up. And that lack of imagination has now cost them across the board. Like DSA's like elected a ton of people to the assembly, the Senate. You know, after 2018, Mamdani was elected in this 2020 wave. I actually met, do you remember Adnan Gabragorgis, who was the second candidate running against Elliot Engel?
Yes, yes. I interviewed him as well at that time, and he dropped out in support of
Jamal Bowman.
Of Jamal Bowman, yeah.
And that was actually a crucial moment because he dropped out and endorsed Bowman, and then it was just a day or two later that Elliot Engel went to this Black Lives Matter
rally. I'm only here because I'm being contested, yeah.
And he was only there, I think, because he now had only one opponent and thought he might lose. But anyway, Gabagorgis was at Zoran's party. He organized the East African voters for Mamdani. And he told me that when he was running in that 2020 race, in September 2019, he went to the AOC Bernie rally, which is right nearby in Astoria, you know, just canvassing, trying to, you know, raise money, get signatures, meet voters. And he said he saw this kid kind of hustling outside of the Bernie Sanders AOC rally. And the kid had some magnetism to him. So he went over and like watched him for a while and watched him speak to people. And he's like blown away. He's like, he's the only candidate I gave money to. Like, he came there to like get signatures, shake hands, raise money. He ended up giving this like 26-year-old Zoran Mamdani $5 for his campaign and stayed in touch with him after that. And he, you know, Mamdani that year knocked off a longtime assembly member. And Mamdani and the other DSA members, you know, formed this bloc in Albany, which caused real problems for Cuomo. And I argued, like, helped kind of push him out. Like, he may have been able to withstand his different scandals if not for this genuinely oppositional bloc that was against him in Albany. And so this has been building for a long time. And the city Democrats never moved the primary. You could move them together, like have everything in September.
Yeah.
Or you can have everything in, although, and you know, having it in September, if you know, you know, really screwed them with George Santos, because they had all of these guys elected in like September, and then they had no time to like be like, oh, by the way, this one's a con artist.
Yeah, I mean, that's the it's a dilemma. And I should also say that this primary garnered, as far as I can tell, I don't know the exact numbers, but close to 20 to 25% more voters than the last mayoral primary.
Yeah, it was over a million.
And the other dynamic, I think, is that progressives were smarter about how you win. I mean, one of the stories was AOC. They people were waiting on her endorsement. She ended up endorsing very, you know, in timing wise, almost the same time she had in the prior race. And from my perspective, I don't know if this is what their thinking was. It made a lot of sense because people don't know that this campaign is happening. You want to do it close so that it's like an action item, right? You don't want like, hey, make sure you buy my book in 6 months when it comes out. No, you want people to be able to act. But one of the stories I read was that like she and her team wanted to see a coalition, you know, like some type of like cohesive strategy by all the progressives as to how you're going to beat Cuomo. And I don't know. Do you know much about that story?
Yeah. Yes. And also, yeah, that is the case. And Brennan Mencia, who's a UAW official who organized the UAW's endorsement of both Mamdani and Lander, they came in very early, and they pushed those two very hard. They said, look, you guys need to be together. Like, this needs to be, you need to cross endorse. Like, you're not going to be able to beat Cuomo alone. And AOC felt the same way. And I you know, there's, you, who knows, counterfactuals, et cetera. But I think it's true. Like, I think Brad Lander's support for, you know, for Mamdani was essential to getting him, to just fortifying him through some of the tough moments. But then also, Mamdani's team was telling me that their early polling had them winning something like 60-40 of Lander's voters. After the endorsement, that moved up considerably to like closer to 80-20 or something, which is really unusual, which shows, like, because usually candidates can't actually move their own voters to somebody else. The voter's like, yeah, I like you, but if you're not going to win, I'm going to choose for myself. It's rare, actually. And, you know, AOC can do it. Bernie can do it. A few people can do it because they become a heuristic in people's minds. Like, okay, yes, Bernie supports this person, then I don't need to look into them. He's looked into it. It's fine. But there's not a lot of people that can do that. But Lander, for his voters in New York, was able to do that. And so, I mean, that was really
significant. He created a permission structure, I think, for a lot of Jewish support to say, like, okay, I trust,
like, broad Elizabeth Warren level support.
Yes.
For college graduates.
Speaking of that, the Colbert Late Show thing. Do you know anything about the sort of like what went into that interview? Because I was very surprised to see Stephen Colbert ask that question, particularly in the context in which he did. It was sort of like almost the first question. But it also struck me like that is a great question to ask. That it's not inconceivable that that was put on the agenda by the candidates, because you are reaching exactly the demographic you want that Cuomo has been reaching with relentless ads. If you want a chance to address that ad, that would have been the time and place to do it. And sitting next to Brad Lander would have been the way to do it.
I don't know enough to say whether or not that was orchestrated or organized. I have heard that it was rocky, like there's more even to the story, that behind the scenes there was even some kind of aggression from around that whole situation.
Oh wow.
Which I'm still trying to report out. So I don't have all the details yet. So I think that I think there could be multiple things happening at the same time. I think there could be some kind of Colbert factions or whatever, you know, inside his staff or something that really wanted like an ambush type of, like, we're going to nail this guy situation. But then you're right that actually it plays to, you know, Lander and Mamdani's advantage. Because not only does it look weird, because it's like, aren't these guys running for mayor? Like, what is going on here? And then really, you're going to be attacking this guy when the two of them agree for the most part about this issue, and he supports him and vice versa. Like, so it does really take the teeth out of it.
I think it was very helpful for Mamdani. I think it was very helpful.
If there were some Colbert staffers who thought that they were going to, hurt Mamdani with that, it shows that's why they're in comedy, and not.
Well, I mean, but Colbert, in my experience, and I haven't, I haven't had a conversation with him in over, probably 10 years. I was surprised by that question. Mm-hmm. Just knowing, what his politics were, at least, I was rather surprised. But all right, let's look down the road a little bit. We don't know who Mamdani's going to be running against. Mm-hmm. It could be like, sort of the ghost of Andrew Cuomo, because he's still going to stay on the ballot, which if I'm Mamdani, and Cuomo's still hemming and hawing, having his name on the ballot is not a bad thing. Because if he's not going to put any effort into it, which, 10%, it sort of feels like it's only going to cut into Adams. And it just makes it harder for, Bill Ackman to know who he's going to pay. I also think, do you have a guess on who Ackman's candidate may be? Because I have one, and I'll say mine first, just so that you don't trump me.
Okay.
Listen to the words I'm going to say. Mayor Seinfeld.
I almost tweeted that yesterday. I didn't want to tweet it into being, though.
No, I know.
So now that you've done it, it's your fault.
There you go.
He did use the word young, and maybe compared to Larry David, Seinfeld's young.
Yeah.
Although Larry David's been old for like 55 years.
Yes, that's true. I don't know.
Now, Larry David ran. Now he'd have to move from LA, right?
Right. Now,
I mean, everybody loves Seinfeld. Larry David. Or, like, that's a real contest.
What's that guy, Pete? What's his name? The guy from Saturday Night Live? Pete Davidson. I honestly think that's what he's thinking in his head. But
I thought he was thinking Richie Torres.
Yes. it's true. Yeah. He's not joking. Matt's laughing because it is that, like.
I genuinely think that's the name. Because also, if you think of what Jerry Seinfeld, I love it. If you read his entire pitch, like that whole post is so worth reading. It's Ackman begging somebody to run and making the case for why you should run. And his arguments are so just playing right to the person's self-interest. It's a short campaign. It's not even that much of a lift. You don't even have to campaign that hard. You don't have to fundraise. I'm going to raise all the money for you. You're not expected to win. So if you lose, it's not actually going to hurt you that much. And you're going to make connections to donors who are then going to be supportive of you for the rest of your career. Like he's just explicitly saying all this stuff.
Yeah.
Which is like nice of him to do in public, because you can like you can imagine him sitting down at in a boardroom somewhere and explaining all this to Richie Torres. But it's like nice to hear him just say it out loud. And then he says, I would say the person's name, but the fact that I'm a Trump supporter, you know, would then tarnish him. So if I just do this and recruit him publicly and then spend all of his money, then he somehow isn't tarnished. But yeah, that's the case that, and he's telling Richie Torres, what do you have to lose? It's 4 months of your life. And then you get connections with us billionaires for the rest of your life.
I didn't realize how insane Bill Ackman was.
He's a crazy person.
It is.
I'm so glad that he's in public, though.
I think this is publicly known, but in 2004, I was writing a blog that was supposed to be a personal blog by a New York Times reporter. And it was back at the time where, you know, people of a certain age could get this wrong and think that the blog was only available to their friends because it was like locked to their friends. And so it was just all this sort of catty stuff. And it's like, does this guy think that nobody was he trying to sort of like get a huge thread of people going like either, you know, Richie Torres should run or, that's a great idea. Oh, this is brilliant. But like anybody with half a brain realizes you cannot do a writing candidacy to win a general mayoral election in New York City. Like,
yeah. And is Richie, does it have a T, R-I-T? Is it R-I-C? Like, is it Richard? Like,
it's,
so yeah, a lot of confusion there. But yes, in that post, he said then, if you have names, please post them below, and then I'll create a poll so that my fingerprints are not on this.
But we know it's him. Like we know.
This is not a WhatsApp group, man. You opened it.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
It's like he thought that he was just doing this on his own Signal channel or something, and nobody else was reading it, and that he would not get a million responses that were all mocking him.
It reminds me of this great Saturday Night Live skit in 2016 where Trump is like, I don't use insecure email. I use this private messaging app called Twitter. And the moderator's like, Twitter, that's public. He's like, and I'm still in the election.
Oh,
that's public.
Oh, somebody was also doing that, like, was it that Chris DeLillo thing where... Like,
oh, yeah, Snapchat. They get access to those
later? You can
take
pictures? Wait, what? all right, last question on this. What happens with, like, we have... Mamdani needs to implement his stuff. He's going to need to win in Albany if he wins the mayoral. Mayorality, and they're going to fight. Not only are they going to fight to keep him from being mayor, but if he becomes mayor, they're going to try and make it the worst, mayorship mm-hmm. in the history of New York. I mean, they're just going to tooth and nail. But it seems to me that Kathy Hochul has a problem.
She does.
Because Antonio Delgado, her lieutenant governor, is already trying to run to her left. And she's been trying to sort of edge over there. And now, like, is she going to want to be seen as the one who's blocking Mamdani from achieving? Like, if I'm Mamdani, on day one, I go up to Albany. Like, I say, thank you for inaugurating me. And then I just go up to Albany and start to do this. Because I got about a year and a half to get this done, it seems to me. So aside from, like, all the implications that could be nationally... of like where it's going to push Democrats. And maybe we can talk about that in later weeks. But for Hochul, this could really push Hochul to the left because she could be looking at Lawler. You know, I mean, that's a general election question, but if she moves to the right, Delgado could, as she moves to the right, Delgado could end up being between her and Mamdani. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very tenuous place for her. And she has never struck me as that bright of a politician.
No. And also Mamdani and Delgado, both former rappers, right?
So I don't know if there's a rapper
Code
or whatnot.
More likely to beat. No, but yes. Yeah, so what he yes. So that's where his experience actually is helpful. Like he does know Albany. If his movement can get primary challengers out in the field, like starting immediately for this for the next cycle, and you have, you know, and WFP out there as well, challenging 10 to 20 assembly members and, you know, 5 to 10 state senators who are wobbly on these questions, and Mamdani doesn't endorse at first, you hold that, you know, the endorsement is the bullet in the gun that you hold back. If these state senators and assembly members pressure Hochul to let Mamdani just do the things he said he was going to do when he ran, like which is not a radical ask.
Like, and frankly, the things that he wants to do are not as radical as people make it. Like, there are municipally owned grocery stores. There are free buses. There are, you know, rent control has been done before, you know, by multiple administrations. You know, none of this stuff is, you know, pie in the sky. It's, you know, this is not radicalism. This is New Deal Democratism on some level. Yeah. It just
and people voted for it. So, like, let them do it. And so, and then if Albany comes through, then, you know, they, Mamdani can disappoint all his supporters and not endorse the kind of challengers to these incumbents, and even endorse the incumbents if the incumbents, you know, allow him to execute on his agenda. And, you know, Hochul then, the more pressure there is in Albany from the Assembly and the Senate, the more pressure there is on Hochul to do it as well, because then she really is the one standing in the way with Delgado over here. You know, like you said, taking up that space. So it does seem like it's not insurmountable. Like the New York Times is just like, oh, he can't do this. It requires Albany, and Hochul says, forget it. But it's not that simple.
No. And I think she's doing a soft forget it so that if there is a candidate to run against him in the, you know, the fall, that's how they're going to run on. Like his program's already dead in the water, but she's going to be singing a different song. You know, we saw her on congestion pricing. She is not adept at this.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what else to say. She is not adept at this. All right, Ryan, I'm going to let you go because I know you got stuff here, but one final thing. There was a big investigative story in Haaretz.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Drop Site News has been incredibly not only consistent but relentless and insightful in its reporting on what's going on in Gaza. We had Jeremy Scahill on, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, talking about the interviews that he had done with Hamas and. This story about it's almost been we've seen it, but yeah. We didn't see what, you know, just how depraved it was that there were orders, standing right. orders to shoot Palestinians coming for food aid.
Right. We've heard it from Palestinian witnesses. We've heard it from the medics and the doctors and the nurses at the hospitals who've treated the victims. We've seen videos of it, but what we hadn't gotten yet and what Haaretz delivered is inside reporting from, you know, the soldiers themselves who are participating in these massacres. And, you know, Israel is such a small country, you know, imagine, it's a country the size of, say, Maryland. And so, you know, I grew up in Maryland. If Maryland was at war, like I would know a whole bunch of the people right. who were at war. And so the journalists in Israel are better sourced than our kind of journalist, because we've got a military of millions. And so if a group of Marines commits a massacre somewhere, like chances that I'm going to know one of those Marines is not very high. And whereas in Israel, they're going to like, these people are friends. They're texting, they know each other. And they're like, you have no idea what we're doing out here. Well, we do have some idea because we're hearing it from the doctors. We're hearing it from Palestinian witnesses, what's going on. And the soldiers are telling them, we're being ordered to shoot at civilians. I had, when I first saw this, and I think I talked about this on Breaking Points, saying it looked like Squid Games, like an actual real life Squid Games. And to see in Haaretz, The soldiers themselves call it the Israeli version of red light, green light. Like, it's depraved on just an utterly incomprehensible level. Every time that these massacres occur, almost every time, the IDF says, we're going to investigate this. We heard that there were warning shots were fired. We're going to investigate this. They never investigated. What Haaretz shows is that if you do investigate, even without the authorities that a military has to investigate itself, you can uncover what's going on here. And the ICC comes into play when a government refuses to prosecute war crimes. Like, that's the condition under which the ICC has jurisdiction. And so the only argument in Israel has for prosecuting some soldiers during that, for that rape in Sde Talom prison that was caught on video, the argument was, if we don't do this, it gives the ICC jurisdiction. It's even that argument is falling flat, it seems.
It just seems like they do not care. And, there has been clear evidence of this, like you say, from the perspective of Palestinians and from doctors. And it's not like with the people in Israel, in Israeli government or in the Israeli military don't see these things. It is a willful blindness, it seems to me.
I saw Mom Donnie shared that Haaretz article today.
Oh, he did?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the global jihad that Kristen Gillibrand was talking about, spreading Haaretz articles.
That's right.
Haaretz.
Haaretz.
Somebody just corrected me on the IM. It's like, do people not watch this show?
He pronounced Ryan Grimm right today, so give him some credit.
I did. I was like, oh, do we have Ryan Grimm on again? Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. I really wanted to talk to you because of all the reporting you did in your, and now you have like a trilogy.
I thought I was done with this.
Ryan has written two books that are sort of historical. What do you a diptych?
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. There? Yeah. Volume one and two.
Having traced AOC's campaign and that concept, and this is a concept that is growing. And like I say, I think this is, we're seeing that this is you really can track it to the Dean campaign in terms of their ability
We've
to understand.
We've got people traces it back there. Yeah.
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 Thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. Know you're on vacation.
Always a pleasure.
Look how dedicated.
Look at that commitment.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We will put those links in the YouTube and podcast description. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Dr. Adam Gaffney. He is a pulmonary and ICU doctor. He is also a healthcare researcher at the Cambridge Health Justice Lab. They put out a report on the projected effects of the proposed cuts in federal Medicaid, and essentially how it's going to kill people. And this is all in that supposed big, beautiful bill. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. Adam Gaffney, pulmonary ICU doctor, and ICU doctor, I should say, and a healthcare researcher at the Cambridge Health Justice Lab of Harvard Medical School. And the one of the authors of a report on the cuts that are outlined in the House and presumably the Senate bill of Medicaid and its implications to people, essentially. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Walk us through what – there's a couple of different sort of provisions that will cut Medicaid. But I want to get to that in a second. But just give us a sense of, like, how much reliance is there on Medicaid for people to get health care and for hospitals to be able to provide health care?
Yeah. So, look, Medicaid was set up in 1965, and since then it has grown a huge amount. You know, it was set up as a program for low-income Americans. Over time, the Affordable Care Act, other provisions have expanded it. So today, more than 70 million low-income Americans depend upon Medicaid as their primary source of health coverage. So that's a huge number. From the provider side, you know, I work in a safety net hospital. So many or maybe most of my patients rely on Medicaid. Many hospitals in, you know, that focus on disadvantaged communities that treat patients from lower income backgrounds rely hugely on Medicaid. It's, you know, given the lack of a universal healthcare system in our country, it's kind of like the foundation of the healthcare safety net. And so that's kind of the role it plays in our society.
Well, where in terms of that growth, the ACA expanded eligibility to Medicaid up to, was it 130% or 140% of poverty?
Yeah, 138.
In all but, I think at this point, 11 states in the country. So that added millions to it. Again, if you're making 138% of poverty, you're not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. Also, the expansion of Medicaid was also a function of two-thirds of our elderly being paid for their time in nursing homes by Medicaid, where people have basically run out of their assets. Spend them down or, you know, with home care or whatever it is and get in there. So there's a wide range of people who are reliant on this. Will you talk about the dynamic between Medicaid, like the federal government and the state government, and maybe contrast that to Medicare?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I think, you know, despite the fact that these cuts are going to be devastating, it doesn't mean that things were well in terms of the status quo. But, you know, both of these, Medicare and Medicaid, were both passed during the civil rights era. And Medicare had a little more of a traditional national health insurance model. It's a federal program. It applies similarly in all 50 states. And it automatically you know, is given to everyone 65 years of age and older, as well as some additional programs. Medicaid, from its inception, was a federal-state program, meaning there are certain rules set at the federal level, and there's federal contributions that go to state programs so that they can they can run these programs, provide this coverage. Now, the problem with that is that historically, states have differed hugely in terms of the generosity of their Medicaid programs. You know, my state, Massachusetts, has a pretty good program. Some states are pretty miserly and, you know, try to only cover the bare minimum. And originally, it wasn't just enough to be poor to get Medicaid. You had to be poor and fall into certain eligible categories, you know, people with disabilities or blind or with dependent children. The big change, as you mentioned, was the Affordable Care Act. That allowed anyone below a certain income to qualify. And it was actually supposed to be for the whole country. But as you're aware, the Supreme Court ruled that it was it had to be optional for states. And so most, but not all states have now implemented this Medicaid expansion. In 2017, Trump tried to really, you know, basically repeal the Affordable Care Act. And that effort sort of famously went down in defeat. There was a lot of opposition. Right. There was divisions within the Republican ranks. I think what they're trying to do now is more similar to 2017 than people realize. They're framing it not as an Affordable Care Act repeal. They're framing it as sort of, you know, making the program last longer for those who are most eligible for it. It's all a lot of nonsense. It would do very, it would have similar impacts as that 2017 repeal.
In terms of like kicking people off and how, and how that happens state to state, we don't really necessarily know, right? Like, I mean, you, different states will impose different sort of like new eligibility requirements to fashion their program to fit the fewer dollars they have. So it, in some states, it theoretically could be, okay, like I happen to know Massachusetts Medicaid in terms of nursing homes. I've had some, you know, I'm from Massachusetts. I've had some personal experience with this. You can't have more than $5,000 assets. In terms of, you know, and you can't have given away the money or anything like that for like 5 years in advance or in the past, before Medicaid comes in and starts paying for, nursing homes. Theoretically, a state, I would imagine we won't see a lot of this, but theoretically they could say, okay, you can only have $250 worth of assets or something to that effect so that they minimize the number of people who are eligible for nursing care. Or they could say it used to be 140%, 138% of poverty. Now it's just going to be back down to 105% of poverty. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to lose their eligibility because of this.
Well, there is. And I think, and to answer your question about the role of states and sort of modifying the impacts, I think that's true and also not true at the same time. So it's certainly true that if you just cut federal support for states in terms of the Medicaid dollars that flow from the federal government to the states, you're right. States will have leeway. How much do they want to pony up to make up for that shortfall? And the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has traditionally projected that states might pony up as much as 50% of the offset of the decline, rather, to offset that decline for certain kinds of cuts. Like if you were to eliminate the boosted federal support for the ACA Medicaid expansion population, that population gets extra support from the federal government compared to other populations. Patient groups. So yes, that is right. States might. Now, I think states are more constrained than people realize, and maybe even in the CBO as previously projected. Are taxpayers going to go for a tax hike at the state level? Are states going to cut other services? Is it even feasible to generate that kind of money, that kind of tax revenue internally in many cases? Probably not. And the other point I would make, and this kind of brings us to the specific provisions of the bill, some of the provisions and some of the cuts that will be realized are going to really be nationwide. It's not just here's less money, figure out what to do with it. It's actually, oh, no, these are new rules and restrictions that will prevent people from actually being allowed to enroll in Medicaid, regardless of what states want to do. And first and foremost in that list are the Medicaid work requirements. Medicaid work requirements, which we, you know, worth talking about, are actually the single largest driver of uninsurance, of loss of coverage in this bill. Nearly 5 million people would become uninsured due to Medicaid work requirements. And so that's going to play out everywhere. Now, yes, some states could be meaner and more miserly. They actually allow states to, you know, require beneficiaries to re-demonstrate sort of compliance at even greater rates than what is required nationwide. But it's going to affect even Massachusetts and even other sort of more liberal states. So it's going to play out in many ways at once. States will have to make choices, but also they will be constrained in their ability to mitigate the impacts of this law just by what's in it.
Okay. And we have seen what work requirements do in terms of kicking people off and in terms of their, I guess, their efficacy. Georgia, Arkansas have implemented programs like this. They got a waiver from the Trump administration in the first term, and they were disasters. They the mechanism that has to be instituted to assess whether people are working both keeps people who are actually eligible out of getting Medicaid and just costs more. So as a savings mechanism, it doesn't work. And as a work incentive program, it doesn't work. But give us a sense of who those 5 million people are projected to be. Are they just strapping young men who are just hanging out, who don't want to work, don't need the cash, but they feel very strongly about being on Medicaid?
I mean, it's such an offensive framing, this whole, as you said, able-bodied man playing video games in their parents' basement, you know, collecting Medicaid as if that's something that you can just like do and enjoy. Look, the end of the day,
I'm banking all of my doctor visits, and I am, you know, sort of just like I'm hoarding all of my doctor visits.
Well, this obsession with healthcare is something that people just kind of want to collect because it's fun and interesting, you know, that you have to impose copay, you know, goes back to this moral hazard concept that you have to impose copays and deductibles because it's almost like a free, you know, buffet. People will just stock up on, you know, and more than they even want or need because it's free, is obviously outlandish. I mean, in the real world, anyone who, I think this is common sense, but also we certainly see it on the healthcare provider side, and people avoid healthcare even when it is available because it's not fun. No one wants to take time out to go to the doctor. People don't like taking prescription drugs. No one wants to be hospitalized. Certainly no one wants to come to the intensive care. You know where I work, right? You really don't need to create barriers to sort of to prevent that kind of, you know, freeloading. It's an offensive framing. At the end of the day, these are low-income people who need healthcare. And when it, as you said, it was studied in Arkansas and Georgia, particularly in Arkansas. And there's a few findings that are worth pointing out. In Arkansas, one study found that 95% of the target population of Medicaid work requirements either was working or should have had an exemption from the requirements on the basis of being disabled, being in school, being a caretaker, one of these requirements. So if 95% met one of these, either worked or met one of these requirements, why did 18,000 people in Arkansas lose health coverage? It doesn't make sense. That number is too high, right? And the answer is very simple. Red tape keeps people from getting what they need. If you create hoops and hurdles for people to jump through, setting up online accounts, documenting work requirements, you know, documenting hours, do this, do that, people fall through the cracks, right? I mean, I think it would probably happen to me. And I am a health policy, you know, researcher and doctor and have all these advantages. Imagine if you're low income, you may have chronic illnesses, you may have multiple medical appointments, you may have a lot going on in your life. It can be really difficult to do this. Now, yes, most of the people who are falling through the cracks are should meet the requirements, but are not, you know, jumping through the hoops. Two other points on this. Number one is that, as you alluded to, these are administratively wasteful programs. In Georgia, they're spending millions and millions of dollars to corporate consultants to run these new IT systems to try to get people enrolled. And it's a dismal failure. They've enrolled in the first year of the program operating, they enrolled less than 2% of low-income Georgians who potentially should have been able to get into to Medicaid. In Arkansas, it was also expensive. So we're actually working on an analysis that finds that, you know, nationwide, these systems would require billions of dollars of expenditures. Overall, they do save money in the sense that they kick people off Medicaid, but at what cost?
They kick people off Medicaid. They keep they're barriered in Medicaid to people who otherwise actually would are even eligible.
They are eligible. Most of the people who will lose coverage are eligible, should remain in the program, and will fall through the cracks. And that is how this is designed, how this system is designed. And when they say, oh, no one would lose Medicaid because of this, if that were true, then how is it generating more than $300 billion in reduced federal Medicaid revenue? It has to be one or the other. Either it's kicking people out and saving money, or it's not kicking people out and it would have no impact on the cost estimates of the bill. Obviously, it does. And so you're really just trading the health care of low-income people for tax cuts for the rich.
So how many? I mean, so the work requirements are going to kick 5 million people off.
That's 5 million, and that's five okay. out of for the Medicaid. So just to run through the numbers real quick, from the Congressional Budget Office, more than 7 million people will become uninsured because of Medicaid. Not only lose Medicaid, but not get alternative coverage. So 7 million Medicaid, about 4 million because of changes in Affordable Care Act marketplace rules. And then another 4 million will become uninsured because of the expiration of enhanced subsidies for Affordable Care Act marketplace plans that will happen anyway without the bill being passed, to be clear. But they're not going to try to lift a finger about that, obviously. So if you total that up, we are talking about a historic increase in the number of people losing coverage in this country, maybe in American history, that is coming down the pike.
And before we get to, I mean, this is where your report comes in, because it translates what the implications of that type of historic loss of health care is. Before we get there, the other myth, well, I should say, when they say, you know, when they know that there are, you know, 5-6 million people, 8 million people are going to lose their health insurance. I mean, not just Medicaid, I should say. But like you say, they're not going to find another program in which to get on. There's only 3 million men in the country who are unemployed of working age. So, like, it's tough to them to square this. Like, are they all able-bodied that are out there? Because they like to make it seem like it's just these guys, like you say, who are playing video games. But the other figure that we hear is there are 1.4 million undocumented immigrants who are on Medicaid, and that is absolutely, fraud, waste, and abuse. How many undocumented immigrants are eligible for Medicaid in this country? And on
I don't have the number in front of me, but it's very few for several reasons. First of all, no federal dollars can go towards the Medicaid care, the Medicaid plans of undocumented immigrants. So insofar as there is Medicaid coverage of undocumented immigrants, it's states who choose to do it entirely through their own internal state funds. That's the first thing.
And so in some ways, it's not even really Medicaid. It's like Kentucky
running
Connect
a program to
or whatever,
give some
yes.
health care to some undocumented yeah. people. It's not enough care and it's not good enough. And but it's something. And the alternative is, let's just call a spade a spade. The alternative is letting these people die in the streets, right? You can talk around this all you want, but at the end of the day, it's not controversial that modern medical care saves lives. And when people say, well, if they go to the emergency room, no one's going to, like, you know, kick them out, you know, of the front door. True, although two important caveats. One is people who are uninsured avoid the hospital. They avoid the emergency room, even in serious situations. Okay. That's the reality. They're scared and they don't want to get hit with a big bill or whatever the consequences. Two, most of the life-saving benefit of healthcare comes from ongoing care of chronic conditions. So if you're not going to see the doctor regularly and so on and so forth, you're not really getting the most of the benefit that modern medical care has to offer. I just want to make one other point on the undocumented front. Work from some colleagues of mine have looked at the contributions that immigrants, both documented and undocumented, make into healthcare programs like Medicaid or Medicare or even private insurance premiums and what they get out. On average, immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, use very little care. Some of that's because they're young and healthy relative to the rest of the population. Some of that is because of discrimination and lack of access. But either way, they don't get a lot of care out. They actually do pay into these programs for a variety of reasons. And on average, they actually subsidize the U.S. healthcare system. They put more in than they get out in services.
And Social Security, for that matter. I mean, it's all wage taxes, billions upon billions of dollars that go in. And because they're not citizens, they can't go and register to get the benefits of Social Security if they're still here in the country. When they retire or become eligible for Medicare or go and sign up for Medicaid unless they're in one of 14 states around the country that have these auxiliary programs, you know, that are with state funds outside of federal Medicaid. So give us a sense of like, and do you have a sense of like the cost? Now, well, because I would like to, you know, talk about like the human cost last, but the actual dollar cost that's associated, because like you say, I'm not doing, you know, I don't want to make it the, you know, the best metaphor I can come up with is if I get an oil change every 3,000 miles, my engine's going to be in much better shape than if I wait 25,000 miles and try and bring my engine in when there's no oil in it or the oil's all gummed up. It's going to cost me a lot more to replace that engine. Without ongoing care, and maybe people show up at the emergency room, or they have an acute problem, and theoretically become ineligible. You know, become eligible because they're no longer capable of working. What is the actual dollar cost associated with it? Do we have a sense of that? I mean, is that something that can be measured? Because I got to imagine for every dollar that you spend on ongoing sort of just whole health type of care, you're saving, you know, money down the road, because as far as I know, 80% of our healthcare costs are born, emanate from 20% of the people in our system because it's acute care.
It's, I wish I could give a straightforward answer. It is a little complicated. And I'll tell you why. As much as I'd love to say if we just gave people really great care up front, we'd save money in the long term, I can't frame it quite like that. You will save lives. You will improve, lengthen lives. You will make people live longer. But what complicates it is that if you're really just thinking this in very crude monetary ways, you know, there are ways to, like, if people smoke, they may actually cost the healthcare system less because they die young, right? That's a horrible thing. We don't want that. So it is. I'm hesitant to say we.
It's hard to measure because yes, yeah, okay, I get it.
But yes, I agree with you. It is silly. What is absolutely silly and what is absolutely illogical is to only cover acute care and not cover ongoing outpatient care, which is more cost effective. Unquestionably, it's more cost effective to do primary care, to do ongoing care, to treat chronic illnesses than to wait for the catastrophes at only. And there's no question about that. But it also does go back to like, what value do you place on a human life? You know, I do think that if you incorporated everything in some very holistic society-wide kind of analysis in terms of what you're talking about with disability and health harms and everything, yes, I do think it is highly cost-effective to provide care throughout the lifespan to everyone. But look, they want a scapegoat. This has been central to Trump's whole healthcare plan, has been scapegoating immigrants from on the campaign trail. They've said this. And, you know, this is and Florida has been doing this before the election. They're requiring that, you know, patients report their documentation status, publishing reports that are very shoddy, alleging that X number of dollars is going towards undocumented immigrants. It's a very small proportion. They probably need better care. And at the end of the day, there's also public health justifications for caring for everyone, right? We saw this certainly with COVID-19, that excluding people from care, you know, potentially for infectious diseases, doesn't really make any sense whatsoever.
Talk about the implications of this bill on providers. Because my understanding is we have about 700 hospitals around the country that are heavily reliant on Medicaid payments because of the nature of the patients that they serve. And that up to 200 of them, particularly rural hospitals, are in danger of just closing because of the amount of patients that they would essentially of patients who could pay, essentially, that they serve, they would just have to close.
Yeah, I mean, it's not complicated, right? If you poor patients use Medicaid. Hospitals that take care of poorer patients rely on Medicaid as their funding stream. These patients aren't going, I mean, we know what hospitalizations cost. Forget about it. Safety in hospitals, and there's been a lot of emphasis on rural areas, but I want to emphasize it's not only rural areas. There's safety in hospitals in urban and suburban areas that are equally at risk. This will pull the rug out from under them. If all of a sudden, a significant proportion of their patients become uninsured, right? We said about 10 million. So, 7 million patients, people may become uninsured who have Medicaid. That's about 10% of all people with Medicaid. That's a huge hit to hospitals' bottom lines. And that's not going to only impact those patients. Those hospitals will have to make hard choices. They can cut staff. They can cut services. They can provide less care. They can close in a worst case scenario. And you've probably heard the Senate talking about some sort of kind of rural hospital bailout fund that would somehow address this issue, because it's very politically sensitive, including for Republicans. I mean, just to give an example, there was a recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll that found that about 64% of the American public is against the big beautiful bill, right? And then when you tell those people while conducting the poll, are you aware this will decrease funding for local hospitals? The percentage who are opposed or view it unfavorably rises from 64% to 79%. Wow. And in fact, you even convert Republican supporters of the bill to the opposition when you just say that. Right. So it's very politically sensitive. But their plan to address it is utter bunk. First of all, the amount of the money in this fund is going to be nowhere near the amount of reduced federal Medicaid spending. So it's just a Band-Aid on a big gaping wound that's caused by the cuts. Second of all, it doesn't do anything for the patients. Right. OK, so the hospital is still there, but I can't go there because I'm uninsured and I'm going to wait until my condition gets worse and not take medications I need. I think it's really just about optics and is going to have very, very little real world impact. Although the details of whatever it is are not yet clear. It may not amount, we have to see.
So one of the fundamental aspects of your study is what's it going to cost in terms of lives, these cuts? Did you tell us what that figure is?
Yeah. Basically our study builds off estimates of coverage losses that have been provided by the Congressional Budget Office, and it combines those estimates with a variety of studies that have been done over decades that really quantify the relationship between coverage and health outcomes. So we look at both lives, but also sort of other kinds of health outcomes, things like, did you get a mammogram within the past 12 months? Do you have a personal physician? Do you take all the medications you need? Did you go into medical debt? So, let's to jump to the deaths for a minute. We have a range of estimates, but our mid-range estimate for the Big Beautiful Bill Act would be more than 16,600 deaths annually that would be stemming from the loss of coverage only from the Medicaid losses. So it would actually be higher if you incorporate marketplace people with marketplace plans. We also estimate in terms of sort of other impacts that, about 1.9 million people would lose a personal physician, 1.3 million would not get their needed drugs. 380,000 would go without a mammogram, 1.2 million would go into medical debt, 246,000 would be refused treatment because of their medical debt. So those are a few figures. And, there often isn't enough emphasis on these health impacts. We spend, the national discussion around healthcare focuses a lot on dollars and cents, and that's important. But we do need to keep in mind what the whole point is of this healthcare system, and that's to help people live longer and better lives.
It's not to profit from?
Well, it depends on who you ask, I suppose.
Does your study take into account, too, the potential of these hospital closures? Because I got to imagine, I mean, I've got to imagine that's going to add. It's very hard to predict, right? Because it depends on which hospitals. And when we say, you know, the 10% patients, we're talking about hospitals where the percentage of patients that are on Medicaid, you know, are over 50% in some instances. And so it's very difficult at that point to calculate, like, what happens if my hospital suddenly is no longer 20 minutes away, but rather 2.5 hours away. Will I go in for my regular checkup? How many acute situations will take place in a particular population? So
and it's not just hospitals too, because we know that when a hospital closes, doctors leave because they rely on the hospital for various things. So you're talking about an exodus of healthcare infrastructure and healthcare personnel. And that's right. In many of these places, there's only one game in town, right? Which is one of the reasons why healthcare has never been thought it doesn't function as in a market way well, because a lot of times you only need one hospital. It's a small community, right? You don't need competition. You don't want competition. But yes, that's exactly right. There will be other impacts that we did not model. As you said, hospital closures. Also, what happens if states do, you know, cut funding to other programs in order to try to, you know, cover some of those holes, right? Then there could be other downstream consequences from that, you know, we're not even looking at. And then there are other health-related provisions in this bill beyond Medicaid. You know, billions of dollars in taking away food aid for poor people. That's going to have health impacts as well.
Yep. Dr. Adam Gaffney. We will put a link to your study on the projected effects of proposed cuts in federal Medicaid expenditures on Medicaid enrollment, uninsurance, healthcare, and health. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. Head into a shorter, fun half today.
An actually 50-minute fun half.
Yes. Getting back to the original vision of the show.
2013 again.
On Mission Creep. This show just keeps growing and growing. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the fun half, but you get the free show free of commercials. Check out our Discord. If you got questions, if you want to organize, if you want to look for other people in your IRL community or an online community, or, you know, you want to talk about movies or whatever it is, we have over 15,000 people in our Discord at majoritydiscord.com. That's crazy.
It's the same population as my hometown.
There you go. It's almost as many who went to my daughter's high school. No, I mean, it wasn't quite that big, but. Also, we've got merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. And the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. We got two great writers there. Corey Pine is there, writing up a storm, and Whitney Wimbish, who has been writing all sorts of great stuff for the American Prospect. She's delivering the news half the time, and Corey does it the other half time. You can find that at amquickie.com. And lastly, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Matt, Left Reckoning.
David Griscom and I will have a Sunday show for folks, watching some fun clips and talking about the news. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning. That's out on Sunday.
See you in the fun half.
1 second.
Three months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey. Matt!
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Key.
You did it! Let's go, Brandon!
Let's go, Brandon!
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? You safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No, stop. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go for a walk.
Ooh, libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundown Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. So shocked. Yeah, folks. It's Friday. Fun half Friday. Short fun half. What? I'm hearing voices in my head.
What was that? Oh, okay.
Emma still out on her honeymoon.
You even call in today?
Yeah. Nope. Although.
Busy, I guess.
Nope. She sent me something. Like, she was clearly on Twitter at one point.
I've been getting a couple DMs about, things local politicians are saying about Soros.
Yeah. And, she can't help herself. I think she's like purposely not sending me stuff. Like, I bet you like 5 times she's had to like delete because she's like, I don't want Sam to think just I'm like not on my honeymoon.
100 drafts.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, she doesn't want to, she wants to make it seem like she's not on, on Blue Sky or Twitter all the time.
Not fooling anybody.
No. ICE is still going around being, thugs. It is incredible to me that the, you know, what we're witnessing here, and it's so unclear to me to what end beyond just a bigotry. I was going to say, like, if I was, I wouldn't know how to look at myself in the mirror if I was doing these type of things. We know how these guys are able to do that. They wear a mask. So when they look in the mirror, they don't have to see themselves.
That's a big tough guy.
It is going to be interesting if the Democrats take control in a year and a half from now. of Congress to find out exactly who are the people participating in these raids. What is the mechanism in which they determine who they're going for? I mean, this is the low-hanging fruit. Remember, they're going after criminals, right? Do you think for a moment, that if there was some type of violent confrontation where the violence was coming from the so-called criminal gangs or criminals, that we wouldn't see this in a loop played over and over again? When they talk about the dangers to ICE agents, it's all, hey, people are going to dox us because they're so disgusted by what we do. People are going to hold us to account for who we are and what we do. People are going to say, you're a person who is has no shame. So literally, a couple of days after we bomb Iran, where we all but call for regime change, although Trump sort of did at one point, where we have people going on television, they hate us for our freedoms. This is an oppressive place. And Iran is incredibly oppressive for a lot of people. It's almost like we should be open to providing them asylum, those Iranians. Well, we did at one point.
Yeah, previously we have done stuff like that.
And what happens is their paperwork goes through a process. But sometimes that changes. And here is a clip of an Iranian pastor in Cornerstone Church, West LA, who happens to be with an Iranian asylum seeker. And then it appears as if his wife, the asylum seeker's wife, has some type of seizure. This is disturbing footage. So if you don't want to see this, pause it or turn it off for the moment. But here it is.
Why are you taking him?
Stay back for a few feet. You can record. Stay back for a couple feet.
No, I want to know. I'm his pastor.
He has no warrants, sir. All right.
For what?
He's being arrested for immigration.
He's an asylum seeker.
It doesn't matter, sir. We're just following orders. He's got a warrant.
Pause it. Can you just I suppose there are people who are so historically inept, but can you imagine saying we're just following orders in this instance?
Yeah, where'd you hear that before?
If that guy has a sense of history, he's got nothing else.
I plead the Nuremberg defense. Good.
He came with CP1. Why are you doing this?
It's no longer valid anymore. That's why.
Why? What?
Please.
Can I have his stuff?
Please, can, no. Yeah, phone. Phone. Yeah.
No, he can't. He can't have.
It. Yeah, only. Okay. Only my friend.
Where you're taking? Can I follow you?
No. Only.
Where's it from? What are you taking?
What?
Hold on. Give me just a second.
Why are you taking him?
Nah, Boratu.
Boratu. Eshkana. Boratu. Boratu. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this?
You want to be arrested as well? You'll be under arrest.
Yeah, I'm a U.S. citizen. Arrest me.
Don't get closer. Stay there. Stay back.
Let him go.
Stay there. Stay back.
She's mad.
Stay there.
Let her go. Let her go.
You don't stay there, you're going to be arrested for interference.
She's sick.
You're going to be arrested for interference.
She's sick. I'm here. She's sick.
Okay, stay there.
She's bad. Call 911. Call 911. She's bad. She has a problem. My God, you're... Why are you doing this? They came from persecution. From dictatorship. I'm from Iran. I'm from Iran. You're so cruel. So cruel. Have you read the news? I was in prison for for my faith. They're there in Iran. They're from Iran. You know, we flee because of our faith. Can you take me with them? They need me.
No, sir. They
have, they need me.
You can stay there and you can be bored, but you can't go with us, okay?
مرجان، 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 اوکی میشه اوکی میشه مرجان جان I know you're doing your job I know you're doing your job but my heart is just seriously, you all guys came for one person?
What is her name? Mark?
مرجان، مرجان seriously only two people is enough what this, like, what's this? It's the army here.
Security, sir.
It's the army. It's like two people.
For who?
Have you read the news? What's happening in Iran? For women? They came here for freedom. Not like this. Shame on you. I know you're doing your job, but shame on you. Shame of this government.
Yep. I think they have a 3-year-old child. That's my understanding. Absolutely just sick. Absolutely sick stuff. Apparently they're also they're Christian Iranians who because of their religion suffer from some type of religious oppression.
Seems like good candidates for asylum.
It's just insane. Absolutely insane. Total monsters.
We didn't play this, I don't think, but Joe Rogan, I don't know if you saw this, he said this. Clipped here. These ICE raids are fucking nuts. Maybe we did play this. Like, we did play this, yeah. But we're going to, if Trump had said we're going to go to Home Depot and arrest everyone, tackle people at construction sites, I don't think anyone would have signed up for that. A lot of the people that you vote alongside absolutely would have,
Joe. 100%. I, you know, go deep into the sort of like anti-ICE on Instagram now. Like, I've like supplanted almost all my woodworking things to find in Massachusetts, like these things. And it is very easy to find comments in these things that say, good, this is what I voted for. It is completely blinkered.
You helped that, Joe.
Yep.
Your big old platform, all the money from Spotify, you couldn't look into what the actual intentions were.
Yep. I mean, just absolutely twisted. Let's read some IMs. Kickut got your back. Sam, you were right. Seems the transgender ban on Medicaid did violate the Byrd rule. Yeah, that's good. Listen, a lot of this stuff is still in flux, too, because they're going to try and rewrite stuff. The AI ban got booted out or was actually passed the first time, but then now it has to be rewritten to be more specific as to what it is. Which, as far as I can tell, will make it a lot less onerous. Because it's basically leveraging federal dollars as a punishment if you, as a state, impose an AI ban. But the money doesn't seem to be significant enough that like a state like California couldn't do it. We'll see. The Supreme Court has really, I mean, the Scrimeti thing is so devastating. that it's going to implicate, I think, other things. But Noah Birdwatcher, no more casual Friday. After your Zoron coverage, I demand we get one day a week with exposed chest. Now loose a couple of them buttons and give us risque Friday. J-Rod, is the text on Sunset Lake card so big that you can read it, Sam? Okay. Jeez. What's going on here? Nate Evans, the Discord wants to meet Brian. We'll see. Maybe we'll dangle that out. Maybe that'll be on Risque Friday. Walter Cronkite, Sam, I'm sure you get this question all the time, but during your time as a colleague of Bobby Kennedy Jr., did he ever casually mention that he enjoyed or took part in hunting humans for sport? Mola to Burrito, that same nationwide injunctions that stopped student loan debt relief, this system is so effed. Without a doubt. Under the Biden administration, there was one judge in, you know, East, forgive my language, bumfart Texas, that was holding up student debt relief for millions of people. Supreme Court provided no relief. Well, there's no rush. It's look.
The question is, does it return when a Democrat's back in the White House?
I can answer that question for you. I will tell you this right now. I have been saying for over a decade that the Supreme Court matters greatly. This Planned Parenthood case is huge. It is going to begin to dismantle like things like Medicaid. It's en route to it. It may not like, you know, take it out totally, but it's going to just bit by bit chip away at it. The Supreme Court, like it or not, is hugely important in this country. And, you know, short of an intervention by God, we're going to be stuck with this regime for possibly decades. Unless the next president of the United States gets in there and is willing to reform the Supreme Court and recognize this is a political body. They are not conservative or they are Republican judges. They are Republican judges. Now, it goes without saying that they're, you know, conservative, but they're functioning. They are a political body. Tom of Link, happy casual Friday, folks. To answer Matlack's question last Friday, yes, Emma made a prediction after I asked her to for the 2023 Men's Rugby World Cup. I remember because immediately afterwards, Emma said that she should have put money on it and was like, oh, darn, what have I encouraged here? But then thought, oh, darn, now I have to deal with an angry bookie with ties to the mafia. Sam's mailman. Y'all talked yesterday a bit about AOC running for senator. I'd like to see Zoran's win influence her to run for New York governor since Torres is out anyway. What are your thoughts on her for governor versus senator? I tend to think that she will be more valuable to us as a senator in many respects.
Yeah, like in the national office.
In the national office, she is such a good messenger and so articulate about these policies. I'd like to see her as a senator. But, I mean, going from governor to you know, maybe a higher office, but we'll see. Superfruit, Mission Gear to here. Mamdani's win puts an extra pep in my step, especially with a senator like Slotkin. I mean, I am convinced that, like, we're going to see people come in and volunteer for Mamdani nationally. Like, I don't know that there's ever, like, it happens. You see it with some congressional races.
People already did it for the primary.
But it's amazing. All right, let's look at what's going on with this bill. There's been a lot of stuff that's happening in the Democrats have been doing a pretty good job, I have to say, in these hearings. They have a little more latitude because obviously, like, they get the principles in for these hearings and doing reconciliation bills. Not quite the same as the budget bills, but the, you know, ones where there's massive cuts. There's people got to come in and got to justify why they're cutting. They got to answer these questions. Here is the Honorable Doug Collins. He was, in fact, a congressperson, so he knows about this stuff. He knows how to prep for these hearings because he was on the other side. Maybe not. This is obviously in the Senate, but here he is being questioned by Senator John Ossoff.
17% to 24 billion.
Not medical care, medical services. So here's your, okay. Just to be clear, I mean, the chairman mentioned this. We usually get.
I understand completely.
Specifies how many folks you intend to employ.
Yeah. He's asking, you have all these cuts here in your budget. And to be clear, Doug Collins is the VA secretary. So they want to know, you have all these cuts in terms of money, but like, where are the cuts coming from? Like, can you outline to us like where these cuts are coming from and why they are not going to have a be problematic in terms of the service that you provide to veterans?
Not medical care, medical services. So here's your.
Okay.
Just to be clear, I mean, the chairman mentioned this. We usually get.
I understand completely.
Specifies how many folks you intend to employ. We have a 26-page PowerPoint, but in that 26-page PowerPoint, here are specified about $17 billion in cuts to the medical services budget. So, what are you cutting in medical services? Who are you cutting? Since that's exclusively personnel.
And this is the issue that we have right now, and I'll just state this for either of us to go back in circles. You'll be getting, we'll be providing more of those numbers, as I said yesterday on our phone call this week. So at this point in time, the numbers that we're providing are the numbers that we have at this point. I'll be happy to talk to you further about those later.
And understand that's why we usually get these in advance of this hearing. I mean, I'm wondering if we need to reconvene having received the full budget request, because the thing that is causing a lot of consternation is this proposed $17-18 billion cut to medical services. I mean, that, and so today is the budget hearing where you justify the budget request. So how do you justify this cut to medical services, and who are you going to fire in order to pay for it?
And I'll go back to the same answer I gave you just a few minutes ago. I mean, in this process, we'll have the more information on that part of it as we go forward. The basis of the budget was based on our workforce as it existed and moving forward, and the numbers have not been cut to the medical.
I'm sorry. Yes,
pause it for a second. Okay, I just want to, because this is getting very Byzantine. Let me explain to you what Collins is saying here. Ossoff is saying, you've got $16 billion worth of cuts to personnel. Doctors, it could be doctors, could be nurses, it could be, physical plant staff at the VA hospitals. It could be social care workers. And so Ossoff is saying, this is the hearing where you explain to us who you're cutting. And so who are you cutting and why? And Collins is saying, I don't know. Or what?
Dog ate my homework.
I didn't. I didn't know that was going to be on the test.
This gives me flashbacks to college. I'm like, oh, crap, I missed this deadline for this paper. I should have had the bibliography done.
I will
turn it in next week.
And it's not even numbers. Like, numbers, obviously, Ossoff wants to know, like, how many doctors? How many nurses? How many people who, clean bedpans? But it's also sort of like, what are the justifications around this? Like, where is it? Where are you providing too much VA care?
The slightest notion of how you arrived at $16, $17 billion for cuts. You know, could you provide us with that?
Is there any other context where, like, this was the big meeting?
Oh, this is a big meeting.
I didn't know. Oh,
I thought we were talking about wokeness.
Dude, I am totally. Okay, my bad.
$17, $18 billion cut to medical services. I mean, today is the budget hearing where you justify the budget request. So how do you justify this cut to medical services, and who are you going to fire in order to pay for it?
Okay. Did not know that was going
to
be on
the
test.
And I'll go back to the same answer I gave you just a few minutes ago. I mean, in this process, we'll have the more information on that part of it as we go forward. The basis of the budget was based on our workforce as it existed and moving forward, and the numbers have not been cut to the medical.
Budget. You have in your PowerPoint here $17 to $18 billion in cuts to medical services. Again, this is a 26-page PowerPoint to justify the budget. So, and this is the budget hearing. So, who's getting fired?
Okay, the PowerPoint is not an easy
program. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if we need to reconvene after they send us the materials, but I think this is insufficient. We clearly, and I'll follow up in my next round. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I don't,
how about you just give me a passing grade and not go on. Out?
Hold on for a second. Let's see your PowerPoint. Do you have one? Because I'm sitting over here, and I'm like, where's your PowerPoint?
I could have just said this.
Now, the proof will be in the pudding, and I'm sure I will understand everything that's happening.
What you're looking at is a number that we derived from taking a number and subtracting that number from the other number, which would give us obviously a different number. So what more do you need to know?
Again, I was saying PowerPoint is defined by the Webster's Dictionary as a presentation software for organizations.
Okay, so you, I'm to believe that you would read the whole thing if it was a bit. I tried to summarize it,
and we'll get that to you.
But that'll be.
It's coming right around the corner.
Yeah, we got a problem with the post office. Maybe we should have a hearing about the post office. You know, it's also interesting, obviously in the same delegation, right? Like Collins from Georgia, wasn't he? And so one gets a sense that Ossoff, maybe not a huge fan.
Familiarity, yeah.
But, the thing that Ossoff does that I think he really gets is that, like, he's got that sort of, like, that Southern sort of respect in that situation. There are other, I feel like, lawmakers who'd be like, is this some type of joke? Yeah.
Here's the rope. Yep. I do like the thing of like, should we just reconvene when they're ready?
Oh, well, that's exactly
that's
right.
That's like constitutionality there.
Yeah. Here is Representative Sam Liccardo. I'm not familiar with him. But he is a member of the House Financial Services Committee hearing. Who is he talking to here? I know this is about the...
Miss Morgan Harper.
Morgan Harper. Now, didn't she run for office? I'm not sure what her position is.
Former CFPB, it looks like.
Yes, she was at the CFPB. I think she ran for office at one point. So she's at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau before Russell vote came in and decimated it. There is a lot of this going on, folks. There's so much news. Like, there are scandals. The eighth, like, if you were to list out the scandals with this administration, the eighth or tenth biggest scandal in any other administration, certainly within the context of a Democratic administration, would be top, would be page one news for half a week. We in the Judiciary Committee, the Republicans are going to vote to nominate ML Bove or whatever, who a Republican appointed, Donald Trump appointed prosecutor has, as a whistleblower, accused of plotting to ignore federal judges' demands. And then they covered it up within the DOJ, and this guy is now trying to become a judge, and the Republicans don't care. I mean, this is huge. The Department of Justice is the top federal law enforcement authority in the country, and they were plotting on how to ignore a federal judge's wishes, or I should say orders. So there's a lot of corruption. Here is Sam Liccardo, again, Democrat from California, in the House Financial Services Committee, walking through what has happened in the wake of Trump destroying the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and just how much Trump got in return for it.
Bank of America and J.P. Morgan were both under investigation regarding the Zelle network, regarding a failure to reimburse customers that were defrauded by scam artists. And
pause it right there. Right there. Okay, look. These banks offer this system to transfer money. They get those fees associated with it, et cetera, et cetera. They don't make it secure enough. People get scammed. They don't provide enough warning. People get scammed. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says, look, you have a responsibility. If you deploy a technology that's going to save you a ton of money, make you a ton of money, you have a responsibility to your customers to make sure it's secure. Make sure the whole process is secure. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is like, you've got to make these people whole. You know, if somebody fraudulently writes a check, one of your checks, and they go and cash it, the bank is responsible to make you whole because you've been defrauded and it's their system that was set up to identify you. People forget this. Most people don't use checks anymore. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau went to these and like, we gotta make people whole. We're going to sue you for it. But watch what happened.
America and J.P. Morgan were both under investigation regarding the Zelle network, regarding a failure to reimburse customers that were defrauded by scam artists. And that action was taken to the CFPB. And what was the result of that action?
Those are also among the cases that have been dismissed.
And Bank of America contributed to Donald Trump and his inauguration, didn't they?
Yes.
Was it $500,000?
I believe so.
And J.P. Morgan, another $1 million?
Yes.
And Capital One, the evidence from the CFPB indicated they may have cheated customers out as much as $2 billion. Capital One contributed $1 million to Trump's inauguration.
Also true.
And what happened as a result to the CFPB case?
They got their case dismissed.
I am puzzled as to why we're having this hearing. As we were watching the defunding of the financial police happening over the last several months and weeks, all I have heard is criticism of whatever happened in the last administration. And I'm sure there's plenty of criticism that's legitimate against the last administration. I don't understand why we're still spending time on whatever happened in the last administration when we know what's happening under this administration is so corrupt and so clearly undermining the interests of every American consumer. I hope that our next hearing is going to actually focus on protecting American consumers and what we can do now and prospectively with a CFPB that has been utterly gutted as the Republicans continue to defund the financial police.
I don't think so.
I wonder if that's a coincidence. I wonder if when the Republicans realize that they're defunding the financial police and that a lot of people who were sued, found guilty of ripping off consumers, who then subsequently donated a ton of money to side to sort of like outside expenditures, if you will, of the Trump administration, they're getting away with it. I wonder if when the Republicans find out about this, whether they'll do something.
Oh, Law and Order. I genuinely think it's a non-trivial part of the Trump coalition is scammers.
Oh my God! The whole thing is built on that.
Yeah, like I mean, from Capital One down to people who like you know do phishing emails.
Oh, are you getting more calls because our information can be sold now much easier than it was? 7 months ago. They're going to destroy the direct file with the IRS. I mean, they're just making life so much worse for people, immiserating people. Again, this all can fall in the same rubric of privatizing the profits and socializing the cost. When you get rid of IRS direct file, the profits go to the lobbyists from HR Block, to go to HR Block, who have been lobbying for stuff like this. Zoom tax or whatever it is. I can't even remember the name now. Turbo tax, Zoom tax. And it just costs you money. It costs society money. And not just in cash, in time, too. And it's less efficient for our government, but that's not the point. That's all that's happening here. Median literacy, vergogna on any pro-life voting voters supporting these Medicaid cuts. Dave from Jamaica, did you guys get to cover that Bill Ackerman's daughter is Marxist? Seems to be the reason why he's lost his mind.
So everyone needs to read the New York Magazine profile on Bill Ackerman, where, among other things, he points out that he's a believer in nominative determinism, which means how you're named decides the sort of path you face in life. So the guy who wrote that was named Reeves. Bill Ackman heard that as Reed, and he's like, Reed, you write. And he also said, I'm Ackman, activist man. So that's the kind of person we're dealing with. And also, he does all those long tweets from an elliptical.
But it sounds like he's going to have to pay the bill for his ridiculous tweet. That is so dumb. Is his name, middle name, dumb? Bill Dumb Ackerman. Let's play this clip of Mamdani on ABC. I found this fascinating, and it's why I think he's going to win handily, regardless of what the Bill Ackermans do. If you are just to look at this guy from ABC, and he's it's ABC 7, but it's local, it's Channel 7 in New York City. If you were just to look at this guy, he's got to be, I don't know, how old is he? He's probably like mid-early 60s, I would imagine, right? A little bit older than me, maybe?
Yeah, he's older than you, I would say. At least looks
please,
the way.
Hopefully. if you were to look at him, he sounds like he's saying something like this in it. And he's probably been on, local television for like 40 years, and he's never had the opportunity to say something like this. Like, it's quite clear that he is more than sympathetic with Mamdani here and is saying this stuff for the first time and so excited that he's able to, like, they're smearing you with this. But saying that it is a smear and just said, I am quite happy about this.
Oh, exactly. You call yourself a democratic socialist. The word socialist, of course, has been vilified and used to attack you specifically. How do you define being a democratic socialist?
I think of the words of Dr. King, who decades ago said, call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, there must be a better distribution of wealth for all of God's children in this country. And it gets to the heart of the matter, which is inequality. And my belief that every New Yorker should have what they need to live a dignified life. It shouldn't be something that they can be priced out of. And that's why at the heart of our campaign is this focus on freezing the rent for more than 2 million rent-stabilized tenants, making the slowest buses in the country fast and free.
There are in the country about 1,200, you know, people who are just wealthy beyond anything, right? Mm-hmm. And in 25 years ago, there were only about 40 of them. Now there are 1,200 people who are worth more than $1 billion and much more than that. That has to be addressed at some point because they're not paying the taxes that the rest of us are paying.
Absolutely.
And I think like, wait.
Is he running?
I was going to say, Mom Dolly's going to like, wait, are you challenging me? Are you going to run? Are you throwing your hat in? It feels like this guy's been waiting like 50 years to be able to express this on television. And now he has the opportunity. That is when Mamdani wins, if he wins, it's going to be stuff like this because this is the problem. People know that wealth inequality, people know that money driving the terms of our society, and not just the existence of money, but the concentration of money in too few hands, driving the terms of our society in such a way to maintain that level of concentration of money in too few hands is the problem. The point where this guy can't even get through the question without answering it.
That's a Bill Ritter who is a 75.
He looks pretty good. 75. I hope I look that good.
Right? And in 25 years ago, there were only about 40 of them. Now there are 1,200 people who are worth more than $1 billion and much more than that. That has to be addressed at some point because they're not paying the taxes that the rest of us are paying.
Absolutely. And I think it gets to the heart of the matter, which is that there is enough money for a life of dignity for all people. It's just a question of whether we have the political will to ensure that money is being spent on delivering that dignity.
That's fantastic. I mean, the next question is Bill Ritter saying, can we have confiscatory taxation, please?
I'm joking. He didn't say that, but it was pretty close.
Augie's Left Paw. Also, in general, I want to thank Sam for doing that. I sent that video to my dad, and that gray-haired guy, his words, not mine, really helped move him. Wait, you talking about me? I was able to debate a Jubilee person Sam debated on TikTok the other day, and it was hilarious. He doubled down on the child tax credit, doing nothing. I asked if he ever got in contact with Sam. Did you ever give that Jubilee guy your number? No, I didn't, but I showed him. If it's the same guy, I'm really disappointed by that because he came into the green room, and I brought it up on my phone. He saw it. He knows. Also, in general, I want to thank Sam for doing that. I sent that video to my dad, and he said that gray-haired guy, his words, not mine, really helped move him.
Oh, he's talking about you as the gray-haired guy?
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Well, speaking of the previous gray-haired guy, I'm sorry, Bill Ritter. I was not familiar with the game. Ritter was expelled from college one semester short of graduation for protesting the Vietnam War.
I mean, I got that sense.
Yeah.
But good for him. Pan Burger Partner, not defending or anything, but can you guys think of a single week since the election that Emma would have been happier to go on a honeymoon? Laugh my ass off. This is the worst week.
Yeah, it's probably the last week.
the Dems will discover was Dr. Phil was the ICE mastermind this entire time. Let's go to Glenn Beck. This is the one discussing Mamdani winning. This is yesterday, the guys on this program were like, they don't know which. It's for them, it's like they've walked into a candy store and they have all of their favorite candies there. The Marxist, the communist, the guy from Africa, the guy with the crazy name,
the guy from India,
Muslim, you know, good
pro-trans,
like it's all there. And it's as if like they want to put, they're so frustrated by having only one hand that can go into one jar one time that they like are trying to go into all the jars at the same time. They're in a absolute frenzy,
paralyzed by choice.
And here is Glenn Beck. When was it? Do you remember when they were doing all the stories about him? He realized how wrong he was and
oh yeah,
how upset he was. Yes. Or it, maybe or it was in the wake of Trump, like Trump is too much. And well, so much for that project.
Man, Z100 852. Something weird is going on.
Yeah.
The World Trade Center is on fire.
Oh, my goodness. Seriously, the top of the building. Oh, we're trying to get information.
Top level of one of the
news to unfold from New York City.
A plane crashed. Just.
My sister's in that building.
Okay.
And I hope she's okay, and I gotta run to New York.
Oh, my gosh, complete pandemonium.
First of all, calm down.
There's raining papers and ashes and.
Wait a minute! Stop just a second. Why are we going in the? I've got breaking news. Breaking news. Yesterday, New York City just elected as their mayoral candidate for the left and the Democrats a Muslim radical who is also a communist.
A socialist, but okay.
So, I mean, it only took you 25 years. It only took you 25 years, New York, to go in completely insane. You know, somebody who is, you know.
Pause it. Well, I mean. Pause it. I just want to, like, we need to walk through this. He plays this montage of getting of 9/11. Our sanity was defined by being a victim of a terrorist attack in New York, according to him. And now we've gone absolutely crazy. Okay, first off, these guys are out marching against a Muslim community center that was like four blocks away from Ground Zero. This is a Muslim community center. In fact, that's where Laura Loomer, I think, made her hay in that day. You have forgotten to hate Muslim people, is what Glenn Beck is saying. He is literally comparing the state lawmaker winning a mayoral primary to a day where two planes flew into the tallest buildings in the country, killing 3,000 people. They're the same thing to him. Good.
Completely insane. You know, somebody who is, you know, well, I mean, if I might quote Michael Malice today, I am old enough to remember when New Yorkers endured 9/11 instead of voting for it. You've got a communist jihadist apologist now who was, care p- put $100,000 behind his bid for New York City mayor. So you got somebody who's endorsed by CARE.
Man, classic.
$100,000. That's almost 3% of the money that the billionaires put behind Cuomo.
Is that 1/300th?
That's really good. He also was somebody who said, he was for the shooting of the United Healthcare CEO.
What?
He said he was looking forward to driving down Mangione Avenue, which, I don't know, it sounds like supporting killing people in the streets. Maybe it's just me. Then he also said that he was going to globalize the Intifada. Which,
oh Jesus! Wait! I think that's like pick your nose right in the middle of that thing.
Yeah. Maybe that's just me. I mean, what do I know? Tim Miller, who's a podcaster, asked him a few weeks ago about his pro-Palestinian slogan, "Globalize the Intifada," and he said, "Well, to me, ultimately, what I hear in so many is a desperate desire for equality and equal rights in standing up for Palestinian human rights." Oh, is that what you hear, Mr. Kerr? Really? That's what you... Huh, that's interesting. Right. So, globalize the Intifada. I mean...
Pause it for a second.
I mean, sure.
Wait, let's break down that critique of what he said there. It was... Oh, is that what you hear? Oh, okay. For them on the right, it's literally all you have to say over and over again is he's Muslim. He's Muslim. Oh, he's Muslim. Okay. All right. Okay. He's Muslim. Oh, okay. Muslim. Go ahead.
Or that's, I mean... Let me go on, because I don't want to take him out of context. He then delved into the semantics of the Intifada, citing the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's use of the word as a translation for uprising in an Arabic version of an article the museum published about the Warsaw Ghetto. Oh, so this is just a comparison about the armed rebellion against the Nazis. I don't know if that makes me feel better.
Pause it for a second. You know, it's interesting because, you know, people spoke about Gaza being an open air prison for a long time or like a massive concentration camp. But really, actually, to be totally honest with you, the Warsaw Ghetto is actually really the model of what Gaza is. The difference, of course, the Warsaw Ghetto, the Nazis were coming in and taking people after a couple of months by the train load. But it's a very similar situation. It was a full section of the city. There was, to the extent that there was power or water or food that got in at any time, it was completely dictated by the Nazis who surrounded the Warsaw Ghetto and walled it in. But there were resistance fighters who snuck out, who, ready for this, dug tunnels to get under the wall. They fought back. Almost all died in that fight. It's fascinating. There was a guy who escaped and went to Britain. And I think he killed himself as a form of protest to get the British to pay attention to what was going on in the Warsaw Ghetto. And it was either him or another fighter from the Warsaw Ghetto whom they named a kibbutz after that was settled just north of Gaza. And if you look at the history of that kibbutz, it very briefly talks about displacing the Palestinians that lived there. Presumably, they were sent to Gaza. that kibbutz was hit on October 7th. I think that they largely escaped deaths there.
But, is this Merrick Edelman you're talking about here, I think?
I think maybe. It's been a while since I read that stuff.
Yeah, it looks like he...
He
was a lifelong anti-Zionist who wrote a letter in 2022. According to the late British writer, activist Paul Foote, he wrote the letter in a spirit of solidarity from a fellow resistance fighter as a former leader of the Jewish uprising, not dissimilar in desperation to the Palestinian uprising in occupied territories.
Well, no, he wasn't the one who, I think, who killed himself. But this is another. I mean, it is fascinating. Nevertheless, this is all they have to say on the right. Which is, incidentally, is there a difference between what Glenn Beck did and what Christian Gillibrand did? Is there a difference?
A few more percent crude from Glenn Beck.
Really?
A few more, maybe? I don't know.
I don't know.
Maybe that's generous.
If Christian Gillibrand was sitting across from Glenn Beck there, would she be like, oh, yeah, well, this is a concern. This is a concern.
All right.
But it's funny because they New York was hated before 9/11 by the right. They hated us. They hated us. And then 9/11 sort of like, oh, there was like 10 years of that. But let me just remind you, like in 1999, when John Rocker, who I believe at the time was a pitcher for the Braves, was having to play the Mets. This was the perspective of the right prior to 9/11. And then we've gone insane in New York. We're actually electing an immigrant to be mayor. I'm not sure if folks know, like, the story of guys like LaGuardia. He did not come over on the Mayflower. I should just tell you that right now. But this is, we have returned back. We've come full circle. 25 years. They're so concerned about New York now.
While Rocker's remarks on our show back in November may have outraged Met fans, it was the comments he made to Sports Illustrated writer Jeff Perlman that caused a national outcry. Rocker told SI he would never play for a New York team. Here's a recap of his most inflammatory remarks. Quote, imagine having to take the number 7 train to the ballpark, looking like you're riding through Beirut, next to some kid with purple hair, next to some queer with AIDS, right next to some dude who just got out of jail for the fourth time, right next to some 20-year-old mom with 4 kids. It's depressing. And about New York City itself, Rocker said, the biggest thing I don't like about New York are the foreigners. I'm not a very big fan of foreigners. You can walk an entire block in Times Square and not hear anybody speaking English. Asians and Koreans and Vietnamese and Indians and Russians and Spanish people and everything up there. How the hell do they get in this country? Since the article hit the stands, Braves senior vice president Henry Aaron has said somebody who feels this way is a very...
Although it was Hank Aaron was actually the guy who had to deal with Rocker.
Would it surprise you that John Rocker had a religious education?
What? No. Seriously? What? No. He supports Trump? What? Unbelievable. All right. Should we play one more? Or no, we got to go. All right. Yeah, we'll say we've got plenty of stuff for Monday. Aaron from Germany. Sam, could you call Gillibrand on air like you did with Torres? Oh, maybe we should do something like that. Nassau County spokesperson. I think at this point AOC is a national figure. As much as I would love her governing New York, we need her on the federal front lines to steer the national discourse left. NYC driver Bill Ritter is 75.
Bradley from Texas. Hi, Sam. Great crew, great show today. Sam, will there be a show on Thursday of next week? Left is best. Yes, there will. Gingerpunk, Ackman sounds like ass man or dumbass. How's that determination of your nominative, Bill? Connie from Jersey, as a trans woman with a chosen name, I think Hackman is on to something.
I'm just opposed to a nominative determinism because my last name translates to lust. So,
whoa. Aaron from Germany, don't worry, Sam. You don't look 75. Thank you. I appreciate that. Maddie Mora, can I get a birthday for my 31st birthday? Me and the family are hoping for Zohran's overwhelming victory in the coming general election so that we can emigrate from Tennessee to the newly founded Islamo-Marxist Caliphate of New York. Happy birthday.
Don't forget trans-Islamic.
Trans-Islamic. Hack All Things, that Jubilee guy should call into the show. Yeah, send me an email, gmail.com. If it's that same guy, I'll be really disappointed if it is, honestly. I actually thought there was some hope for him, but maybe the dollars aren't there.
One step forward, two steps back.
Emma Jordy enthusiast. Chud Watch, Zohran edition is excellent. I want to drink this cocktail, Republican and capitalist tears forever. Punch a drunk pulpit. R.I.P. to the legendary Bill Moyers. His work was a big part of my early political education. His interview show was the first time I was introduced to a certain Vermont senator back in 2012. Oh, you should have listened to the majority report. You would have been introduced back in 2004 or 5, I think it was. All right, three more. Lefty band teacher. Beck himself is part of a cult. So it's always difficult to take any kind of serious when he criticizes someone for their religious beliefs.
It's so crazy that religious fundamentalists in like suburban compounds like Glenn Beck, or even just American Christians in general, think they're setting some kind of example as far as being compatible with democracy goes.
Verbonia, Beck just running down the based Mamdani selling points here. Josh from Minnesota, did Saul's DIY computer ever get finished? We're very close, but we still need help. Send an email. But we're not going to be able to do it for a bit. My brain hurts. Hey, Sam, dat cat black on blow. What? I don't know what that means. Kowalski from Nebraska. Those who do not let compromise positions like Frederick Douglass policies, advocacy, a reality, make John Brown actions an inevitability. Democrats need to be very clear that they're lining up behind Mamdani mandate or they will make Chris Matthews' nightmares an inevitability. Glenn Beck will be sent to the 89th for the Empire State Building, if you know what I mean. You mean the 86th.
I get 86th.
CNF, Sam, to your point, check out the panel on CNN where one panelist literally said the people are afraid of Mamdani simply because he's Muslim.
And next week, we'll get to that.
And the final I Am of the week. Let's see. Anonymous. It's also important to remember the occupation of Warsaw was only lifted after external support from a superpower, despite the bravery of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. And then the more coordinated underground resistance to the Poland uprising both failed. Even the United States' own fledgling revolution would have failed without external support from the French superpower. Matt, Brian, Emma, on your honeymoon. Great job today. See you Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bar. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for
I'm not somehow.